We're here live with Native Questions.
Native Questions.
You're listening to Native Questions.
Native Questions.
You are listening to Native Questions. For more podcasts like this, please visit our website, nativequestions.com.
Hey everyone, this is Abril Rodriguez with my homegirl,
Reina Guzman.
And Mayra Rodriguez. No, we're not sisters.
No relation.
So in today's podcast, we're going to be talking about forced migration.
We will be focusing on the forced migration of indigenous people, but we will be looking at how foreign policies have affected or caused forced migration.
In particular, in the region of Mexico into the United States.
A couple of weeks ago, we were able to have the privilege and the honor to sit down with Diana Mendoza, an indigenous Purépecha mujer, who was able to share with us her story of migration. Not only was this experience impactful, but a lot of us were able to not only learn, but reflect in her experience.
In our own journeys, myself, I'm an immigrant, and I came as a young little girl, and I personally didn't experience much of the strenuous circumstances that she was put under or had to face. But definitely her story is one of resilience and it's an empowering one that I found myself really inspired in and really want the world to know her story.
I was raised in Lázaro Cárdenas. That's kind of a big city in Michoacán. It's kind of like at the coast. My mom, she comes from Guerrero. Mm-hmm. My dad comes from Uruapan. And that's the main areas where we see the indigenous people, more specifically Purépechas.
Would you mind sharing a little bit more about your background and how you identify?
Yes. So in my background, it's a little bit scrambled because my parents, they kind of cut their cultural practices, if you can say.
Mm-hmm.
On both sides, I know I have indigenous blood, but there's a gap. On my mom's side, we can see that it stopped with my great-grandparents when they died. I've heard all the stories with my mom about how she used to go with them to the festivals every year. My grandpa would participate in the dances. He would trade what we call pinole, which is a type of flour toasted. And my mom would be dressed up in a traditional regalia with a huanengo. It's kind of like a dress. Just adorned with flowers, and we have a rebozo and a mandil. My grandma, she was never interested in that culture, so she kind of stayed away from it. And when my great-grandparents died, she didn't pick it up. And my mom was too young to do it by herself, so we pretty much lost the connection right there.
Wait, if you think you're hearing a baby, you're not going crazy. Diana's two kids actually joined us during the interview. And the baby who's screaming is her little son, her little baby son.
But I think overall that's really important because coming from immigrant parents and a lot of my family members that are immigrants, I think it's important to point out that a lot of my cousins sometimes don't even speak the language, right? Even our own language is not our language. And to be in a space where she's sharing her story and her children are there listening to this, to me it's really impactful because not only do they have the knowledge of where mommy comes from, but also like this is where mommy's traditions and cultures. So I think it's beautiful, although we do hear the baby screaming in the background at times.
Can you tell me a little bit about your how you identify?
I do identify myself as a Purépecha. Even though my parents did not carry on to the tradition and did not catch on to the language, I do consider myself indigenous.
Okay, thank you. And I guess my other question, and you kind of do talk about it, but how was it like growing up in, I guess, in Mexico?
So Mexico's it's a little bit tough. Like I mentioned, my parents are in between a small colonia and a big city. So they are not close to the other Purépechas. And since they did not grow up with the traditions and they did not dress like it and they spoke Spanish, they never identified themselves really as indigenous to other people. Mm-hmm. So we never really experienced any type of discriminations against us. Mm-hmm. But you do see the big difference when you're indigenous in Mexico. You do see the injustice in general. If you are indigenous, you're thought of to be kind of stupid, if you say that. You are thought of to be illiterate, that you don't understand the culture or the modern ways, especially politics. You can't work on other besides being a farmer or a maid. Mm-hmm. And most of all, you are definitely not expected to have any type of education. Mm-hmm. If you go to their villages, you see there's no running water, there's no electricity. They live in extreme poverty.
What was your experience with education or schooling or any sorts of programs like that back home?
So back home, as I mentioned, my parents were fairly stable. My dad had, he was a butcher, and my mom used to sell food on the street. So we did have some type of means to survive. And that is what allowed me to go to school. I used to get up every morning at 5 in the morning, 6 o'clock, be in the bus stop, and go to school. Wow. But as you can see, if my parents did not have that, the business to be stable, I would be unable to go to school. So if you think about other indigenous where they don't have the monetary means to set up their own business, there's no way that they can go to school. There's no way that you can have or expect to have any type of education at all.
Thank you for sharing with us your experience going through the education system in Mexico or even having a lack of access to it. My next question is, when did you migrate to the U.S. and what were some of the factors that influenced your migration?
So I migrated in the year of 2002. So as I later learned, it was a year after 9/11. So I didn't really thought of like the dangers that I would have really run and the level of security that there should have been, really. The factors was that my parents' business pretty much started to spiral down. They were not having enough gains or money to keep supporting us. They found themselves, the community, asking them for money to lend them food, to lend them meat. My mom would be like, can you please give us some food? I will pay you later. And we knew that money was not going to come back. And all this happened after the NAFTA agreement. If after that happened, we saw that everybody just started keeping getting poorer and poorer. They couldn't afford anything anymore.
Wait, so I thought NAFTA was supposed to be good for the economy.
Well, not necessarily for all economies that were in that trade agreement. So NAFTA is formerly known as the North American Free Trade Agreement. That was done in 1994. But due to this, many indigenous communities were harmed by the subsidized imported products that hit the Mexican market due to NAFTA.
To be specific, that NAFTA was beneficial for people who had money, right? Not for the indigenous and ordinary working class. People that from either side of the border, from Mexico and from the United States. So NAFTA did benefit a certain group of people, but it wasn't going to benefit the ordinary working class.
Under these circumstances, Diana and her family only had about 2 options.
Next year, we found ourselves a job to help them out, or we try and come and get here to the United States, see if we can make it here. Nothing was said there was no really plans of what would happen once we got here. But we decided to come here and try something new instead of, with the hopes that we will keep studying.
So Diana starts her journey as a 12-year-old girl, along with her aunt and uncle and brother. Of course, with the help of one of her aunts that already lives in the U.S., I was able to get a hold of a coyote that would be able to help them out. Little did they know that what was told to them to be a 3-day journey turns into a longer one, which she is going to go into. And it starts with them trying to cross the river without even knowing how to swim.
And even the safety problems, you know, this coyote wasn't someone who they trusted. Just for clarification, a coyote is someone who helps people migrate from Mexico or from any other place to the United States, usually through either the desert, either swimming, or some people even cross through the actual border.
So these people are basically putting their lives on someone's hands who they don't even know.
Yeah.
Also important to add to Mayra's comment is that a coyote is someone who's paid, and usually yes. A coyote is, you have to pay like $1,000, you know, something that's, if you're working class, if you're poor, it's difficult and it's a challenge to earn that money and do that. But people do it because they have a need. And so part of that need that Diana talks about later on is that in the journey that she took on to migrate, there was a Salvadorian man who's actually 60 years old and is trembling through this journey with them trying to cross the border.
So Diana, when the coyote is telling you to take off your clothes and get ready to walk across the river, what was going through your mind?
I don't want this to be any deeper. I don't know how it's going to happen. I don't know if I'm even going to make it across. So I was holding on in my tippy toes, you know, onto the rocks. They were all slimy, trying not to slip.
Mm-hmm.
We did have a small hiccup. My older brother, he slipped, and we thought the current was going to take him. But luckily, my uncle, who was behind him,
mm-hmm.
Grabbed him from the shirt and pulled him back into the line. I mean, that was pretty scary for me. I thought I was going to lose him there. Like, I saw him floating away, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, luckily, we all made it. We all made it across. And that night, we walked the whole evening. Until we found a small hill. We rested for a few hours. We tried to sleep, but it started raining. So I turned on my back, put on the backpack, you know, as a pillow, try to rest my head. But 30 minutes after that, I heard coyotes.
Wait, Mayra, she was talking about real animal coyotes, right?
Yeah, the real ones, the ones that bite.
And all I kept thinking was, we have food in the backpacks. They're probably going to attack us. I can literally hear them and feel them on top of us. We were right under a big rock.
Mm-hmm.
I was just praying that day. I was praying, please, please don't let anything happen bad to us. Right now, we just started. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know what happened. Probably 15 minutes after I stopped praying, they left. We ended up sleeping the whole night after that, instead of the few hours as he had mentioned before, the coyote had mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning, we got up early in the morning, I want to say maybe 5 in the morning, mm-hmm. and we started walking. Again, that's when we crossed a few big fences. It was, I know we crossed at least a 10-foot fence. We had to climb on top of it and, you know, go over it. I remember trying to help the Salvadorian guy. I mean, mm-hmm. he was struggling. And I know he didn't hurt his foot once he came down because he after he went across, he was walking with his foot bended in. So, you know, all I kept thinking is how is this guy gonna make it? It's amazing that, you know, somebody has that need to cross at that age. So, I mean, all our journey was walking. Our third day came, and I mean, I asked the coyote, like, when are we gonna get there? It's our third day. You promised us 3 days. But by the end of that third day, I mean, our water was already running pretty low. So we asked if we could stop somewhere or if there was a place where we could refuel. So he knew of a couple places that we could stop and see if they had water. He wasn't sure yet. We stopped at this ranch, but he came back saying that there was no water in the well. We kept walking, but it started raining again. And it just became so difficult. We were already exhausted. Our feet kept getting caught into the mud. We weren't walking fast enough anymore. And on top of that, we were fighting to get through the bushes. I know my arms were all like torn apart with thorns. They were bleeding. My feet, my legs, they were full of the cactus thorns. I could see the pus pretty much coming out my end, that she actually fell on top of a cactus plant. So that was a little bit, to me at the time, was funny, but I was laughing. But I mean, it was sad afterwards when she got out, because you could see all the thorns on her belly and how that pretty much slow her down afterwards. It was hard to take all of them, so she had to suffer, you know, the feel of them every time she walked and rubbing into her clothes.
You all know what's funny is that when I was young, I actually fell into a cactus plant or tree, and although I remember it being quite painful, I can't imagine having to walk like miles and have it rub my skin.
After that, man, I don't know how to say that. I mean, after that day, the next morning, he told us that we're going to hit this new ranch and that we should be able to get the water there. That he always gets a refill there whenever he needs it, and that he was almost sure he was going to get it there. So we go, and there was no water either. There was gallons on the floor. You know, on the ways there, but he told us we couldn't, because most of them that he knew were poison. So, I mean, it was such a mind game as to whether to keep going without water and die without water, or drink water that's poison. Luckily, by the afternoon of that fourth day, we came across a lake. So there was a lake, it was full of cows. So all around it, you could see the cow feces and mold and all that stuff. We didn't mind. We filled up those gallons and just put in, you know, our dirty, sweaty shirts on top of the gallon and started drinking like that. At the moment, I didn't really think about what that water would do to us, but it's just amazing that honestly none of us got sick from it. I mean, I had to keep pushing, right? We were already 5 days in. There was no way back. We walked the whole night to the fence. I know that by that sixth night, I mean, my energy level was so low that even the backpack that I was carrying was so heavy. I had to drop it. I didn't even think that I was gonna eat anything I had. The money that my mom had given me that I was carrying the whole way, I didn't even thought about it. I just dropped the backpack with everything. Money and everything. All I was carrying with me was my water bottle.
So Diana and her family finally reached the U.S.-Mexico border fence, and they're instructed by the coyote to actually to go under the fence instead of over the fence, because it would be an easier process. So it's the brother goes first, the aunt, and then Diana's turn, and she unfortunately she gets a little stuck. Her shirt gets stuck. But, you know, the girls and I were talking about how it's incredible how we just heard Diana's story about how long it already took for them to get to the border, and what a lot of people always have in their mind is this picture of people just hopping over the fence when they're talking about Mexican immigrants, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's important, because when we think of, or when the media has often portrayed migration, it's like, oh, especially the racist comments that are made, like people like Minutemen and, you know, just those really racist groups that are talking about, like, oh, these Mexicans are jumping over the fence at large amounts. And as you think about, like, this is one person who has, up to now, has survived all these challenges, all these tribulations, all these, like, dangerous obstacles that not anyone can do, right? Not anyone can survive 6 days in a desert without water, right?
It's intense. And, well, just like a reminder, as we learned from the end of the story, like, it's indigenous people, like, who cross, and also Salvadorian people and Mexican people. And all these people, like Abril and Mayra said, are usually, historically, have been portrayed as having like a pretty simple journey of just coming over to this country and taking our resources. But at least for me, it was important that for us to listen and to learn Diana's story and all the struggles, as Mayra mentioned. And at the end of the day, like, all the security stuff that they invest on, like, it's like people are always still going to be crossing.
And
they're always going to find a way.
Because, like, there's always going to be a need, yeah, to.
As long as we have, like, policies that are
messed up, too. Yeah. Especially, like, as we see, like, especially within, even, like, people, like, not even, like, the people who are well off in Mexico, it's the people who don't have nothing.
Yeah, or, like, when people, like, come from El Salvador, like, the older man who's, like, what, 64, in his 60s, and he's coming from, like, Central America, and he's, like, crossing. And he's still trying, you know.
And, like, historically, also knowing, like, the what was going on, the U.S. U.S. policy in El Salvador, right? With the civil war that was going on in El Salvador, like, a couple years back. You know, when we think of El Salvador, like, the movie of Voces Inocentes, or Innocent Voices, right? Knowing what was going on that time with the guerrilla and everything, and like, people, that history is often not, like, when someone crosses, that history is sometimes taken away from them because of the obstacles, you know, that, like, a lot of them don't make it, unfortunately, and hundreds of people are dying in search of this better life, or in search of this better, like, a better future for their children. And we think of Diana. Diana's 12 when she's enduring this journey, and I think about myself at 12 years old. Would I have the mental capacity to, like, overwin or overbeat hunger or overbeat, like, fear, like, being alone just with my aunt, you know? Or, I don't know. It's really, like, as someone who can reflect of not having none of this ever happen to me, which I'm really, really fortunate and privileged, it makes me feel like these people are, like, true heroes in a way, because, you know, not everyone can say, well, I was walking the desert for 7 days and I made it, you know. And I think this is why it's important to tell these stories and give people like Diana these spaces and to share.
And remind ourselves that these are forced migrations. People are not being physically dragged here to the U.S., but they sure are economically. A lot of people, we have refugees, and so I would consider her an economic refugee, or a lot of the other indigenous or Mexican migrants who come here and are not considered refugees.
So, Diana, at this point, has everyone crossed? Did everyone make it? Can you tell me a little bit more?
We waited there, you know, with I waited with my aunt and my brother for about an hour. And once again, you know, no sign of them. I thought it was getting too, it was too much time had passed, you know, and we haven't, had not seen anybody else come by. Then we see the coyote, he comes back and he says, hey, you know what? Your uncle and the other guy couldn't make it, they got caught. The coyote said that, I mean, when he went back, he whistled for my uncle to cross, but instead of my uncle crossing, he was helping the older Salvadorian guy go on top of the fence instead of under, because he had told my uncle that he couldn't go under. He was, I guess his joints couldn't afford, you know, to go make himself smaller and bend that much. So it was the time wasted pretty much of trying to get him, you know, across that, that pretty much led to immigration, you know, having a routine drive around and happen to see them. We convinced our aunt to stay, you know, we kept telling her, you know what, if he got caught, just stay back, at least work for, you know, a few months, and if you want to go back, go back after that. And, I mean, she decided to stay, so, okay, we kind of felt relieved there, but then it was back to another hiccup. I mean, after immigration picked up my uncle and the Salvadoran guy, I guess they kind of knew that there should be more people around. So we heard the helicopter kind of like circling on top of us. So then the coyote was like, okay, just find a tree, hug it, and stay there, you know? I felt my heart pounding so hard. I mean, I've never felt it like that before. But this helicopter was literally circling on top of us, and he did not come and, you know, and get any type of immigration personnel come and get us. We finished that night, and one more day. One more day of walking. I mean, no food. No backpacks, nothing. It was just our water. So we finished that. We finished that seventh day. But by that night, we finally reached our destination. We pretty much reached. It was in the middle of nowhere, in between like mountains. So it was kind of like the bottom of the mountains, and it was only like 5 trailer homes. We got there. The coyote said, yeah, you know, my friend lives here. We're gonna get some rest here before I deliver you to your family. Since there was nobody there, he just broke in. He just broke in into one of the trailer homes, and he got a gallon of milk and some bananas, and that was the most amazing food that I had tasted. Oh my god, I still remember the taste and how it felt so good. That morning, he told us we're gonna go to our family. He got us into a truck, in the back of the truck. I know I was, my aunt, my brother, and I were under tires. So he said, don't move, just stay here. I'll let you know, to come out and, you know, when everything is good. But then I heard the coyote, I said, like, well, no, this is not gonna happen. You need to have the money. And then, I mean, I didn't know what was going on. So all I felt was him getting into the truck and driving again. When he finally opened the, let us out, we were back into the trailer homes. So he was like, you know what, your family didn't have the money. So if they don't have the money, I gave them until tomorrow. If they don't have the money, I'm going to take you guys back. And the next day, once again, we're back into the truck with the tires on top of us. And I was just praying the whole time, please let this be it. You know, I can't go back home. The next day, I did recognize, you know, a familiar voice. That was my aunt. I recognized her. I had seen her only twice in my life. But I did recognize the voice since we spoke on the phone once in a while. And he finally was like, okay, yeah, that's fine. You know, that's all I heard. And I saw the door open and all I did was run. I ran into my aunt and into her her van. She pretty much explained to us that person from the first time was was our cousin, that he was in charge of receiving us since she was outside of town and that she had entrusted him with the money. But we found out that he spent the money. But that was my experience crossing. I mean, we did have a few hiccups, and in the end, we made it. But like I said in the beginning, it's just surprising that nothing really happened to us and how lucky we were.
First and foremost, we want to thank Diana Mendoza.
Thank you!
And her family, her beautiful children, and her husband for allowing us to share this story in this moment with her. We understand that learning takes a form of storytelling at times, and this was a really good learning experience. I think the ladies will agree with me that.
Yeah, thank you.
Most definitely.
Thank you to the Intertribal Resource Center at UCSD for allowing us to use the space and be comfortable and interview the wonderful Diana Mendoza.
We'd also like to thank the listeners for tuning in
and sharing this story, and a special shout out to the professor.
Yeah, special shout out to Professor Wayne for
Profe of the Year.
Profe of the Year award.
Hold up, Abril, where can they find the full interview?
Not only can you find this podcast there, but you can also listen to the second part of the podcast, the unedited version, at nativequestions.com.
To get a little insightful look onto what Diana's up to now and her experience after migrating here.
Peace.
Peace, everybody. Thank you.
We're here live with Native Questions.
Native Questions.
You're listening to Native Questions.
Native Questions.
You are listening to Native Questions. For more podcasts like this, please visit our website, nativequestions.com.